Few more terrifying minutes passed before Doc swung open the door and stepped aside, letting in two broad-shouldered women wearing the nun robes. The nuns gawked at me. Then Doc snapped at them. "Sister, strip her quickly and give her two Nembutal suppositories," he stormed out. I pushed a protest past my fear-thickened throat and tried to go after him. One of the nuns grabbed me by the coat, yanked it and my bonnet off. The other reached inside the medicine cabinet and pulled out a large bottle. Together, they came at me, blocking me against the wall. I kicked and slapped at them, screamed and cursed until the larger one wrestled me to the floor, stuck her thick-knobbed knee in my back. The other stripped off my skirt and then my undergarments. I struggled to rise, but one had my head locked to the cold tile, her knee digging in deeper. Then the other one knelt and lightly touched my behind, whispering, "Have you ever, Sister Doreen? Look, it's as blue as lake water on a bright day." She pressed her icy finger to my skin, poking before giving my bottom a stinging slap. A killing rage grabbed hold inside me, and I let out a murderous scream as I tried to wriggle free, spit and bite at them, but caught nothing more than air. The large nun had me pinned down tight. She laughed and smacked my bottom again. "Look at it now. It's plum purple." "Get the Nembutal inside her," the one atop me ordered, and dug her knee even harder into my back. They pried me open, pulled back my skin, and inserted something hard and hurting inside my bottom. It went slippery and warmed. Quickly, they tossed the slitted robe over me. Then the nuns hauled me up onto the cold metal table, splayed my arms and legs high and wide, securing them tight with leather straps to the rails, leaving me open, exposed under the dangling, buzzing bulb above. Weren't no time before my screams hollowed under a thickened tongue, and I could barely make out the doctor's faces hovering over me. Drugged, I felt bare skin, their busy hands bumping, crawling over and down and inside me as their excited voices floated into a fading, gurgling string of words. "Take a swab. More blood here. More samples. More. We're going to make history. The best journals will fight for our articles, our analyses, and photos." I tried to move, but sleep sank its teeth deep. My lids grew heavy, and darkness came fast. Chapter 17. I stirred awake from a drugged slumber and realized I'd been shoveled into the back seat of Doc's motor car. The confused memories of St. Joseph and medical journals, samples, bolted my sore body upright. My crumpled bonnet had been placed under my head. As I leaned my head against the window, I felt a sickness crawl into my belly and rise high in my throat, the hazy blur of trees and road rushing by, dizzying. Moaning, I curled back down onto the seat, my breath short and fast. Soon, I escaped in sleep. The motor car bumped over something, growled its engine, and I awoke, raised a crooked arm over my face, the daylight harsh and hurting my tender eyes. Instantly, I held out my hand. It was bandaged up the length of my arm. I pressed on the dressing and felt the tenderness. Unraveling the cloth, I traced the tracks of blood on my veins, the skin bruised and swelling, the ugly strap welts, raw and deep.
What did you do?
I pulled myself slowly up and leaned over the seat, the fear tightening my voice. What? Doc turned his head partway toward me.
"Ah, you're awake. Good. Don't worry, it won't scar," he said quietly, and then more pert, "You'll be fine, dear."
He snapped his attention back to the road.
"Fine as one can be with chocolate-colored blood, I reckon."
Chocolate. I peered at my arm, picked up the cloth. Brown bloodstains riddled it.
"I'm sorry the nurses were rough with you, Blewett," he said. "But it was important, very. And we'll learn soon about your family's blood and how we can fix it."
"Fix you, my dear." I felt the spark of anger slip behind my eyes, prompting a headache. What I wanted most was to be okay as a Blue.
I never understood why other people thought my color, any color, needed fixing. It'll be wonderful to fix you, won't it? Fix. Again, the chilling word caught in my throat, and I suddenly wished Mama had fixed my birth with some of her bitter herbs. Then I would have never had to suffer this horrid curse of the blueness. Still, Doc said it would be wonderful, and I couldn't help but wonder what my and Pa's life would be like if we were fixed. The confused thoughts made my head pound harder. I reached up and touched my neck, looked at my arms and leg, pressing for more tender spots. A cramp took hold low in my stomach and cut even lower. My innards, I'm feeling cramps, I said, too tired to be embarrassed. You're fine. We took some blood and a sample of tissue from your cervix, a few skin scrapes from your scalp and the back of your shoulder. Nothing that will harm or cause you permanent pain, and nothing that a good night's rest with laudanum won't fix. He rattled a bag and pulled out a pear. Aletha packed this and some cheese here. Would you like to eat something? I ain't hungry. It hurts. Everything hurts. I doubled over. I don't want to do this anymore. Only for a bit, I promise. Listen, Blewett, we may be able to cure you, make you white. Wouldn't you like that? He asked gently and pulled the motor car onto the side of the road. Maybe there weren't anything a Blue should like better than becoming normal like that, but the pain and fear left me shaken and crowded out those possibilities. It would be safer, my dear. When you're white, you'll never have to worry about the likes of Frasers or others who might want to do you serious harm or worse because of your looks. The words lay cold in my cramping belly. If I didn't let Doc have his way, there would be worse pains coming for me and Pa. Many a colored have been hanged for less, looped in my brain and left a fear in the pit of my belly. From the front seat, Doc rummaged inside his medical bag and pulled out a small bottle and a brown dropper and handed them to me. Take one drop now and two drops of the laudanum before retiring to bed tonight. It seemed like I had barely touched the dropper to my tongue, tasted, when my aches began easing. I inspected my arms more closely. The pokes and scratches weren't nothing more than a nuisance. Curious, and then surprised that I was okay, I corked Doc's little brown bottle with the tiny plug and tucked it into my dress pocket, while something bigger took hold in me. I need something to heal these scrapes, I hinted. Oh, yes. Yes, you do. He dug deeper into his satchel. We wouldn't want you ill. No, sir, I agreed. And we ain't had much food lately, and I get weak need some. Here, take this pear and cheese, and I'll bring more soon. See that you get some blocks of cheese and bread. Blocks of cheese and bread? I almost clapped out a cheer. And here's a bottle of rubbing alcohol, dear. He handed me the bag and a larger bottle of the clear liquid. And you can always use honey to dress the wound after you clean it with the alcohol, he added, reached in again and pulled out a full bottle of honey. I want you to be comfortable, to have everything you need. Any Kentucky woman knowed the worth of honey, that it was good for all sorts of ailments. It was just getting your hands on some that proved difficult. Nearly forgetting the hospital and the harshness of the day, I clutched the prized bottles to my chest and managed to smile back before tossing it all into the soft belly of my bonnet. Soon I grew drowsy and curled back down onto the seat. Chapter 18. We arrived back in Troublesome just before dark. The old mountain doc toted me back through the woods on his horse, seeing me safely to my cabin. Before he left, I caught him staring at my crumpled clothes, unkempt hair, and fallen braids. He dug into his coat. I almost forgot, Blewett. I picked these up for you in the commissary. He handed me two satin ribbons. Yes, your hair ribbons were lost during the exam. He reddened. Weren't no ribbons in my plates, just twine. But I marveled at the lovely new white garlands, murmured a thank you that surprised me despite the intent in his wise eyes that the gifts were meant to bribe me into more testing. Generous, but it would all change if I refused. My eyes searched the yard, landing over past Junia's stall where the preacher lay in his shallow grave. A shiver latched hold and rolled violently across my shoulders. Alarmed, Doc said, "You're cold. Let me get a blanket from the pannier." Instantly, I took a step back, wanting to take my leave. "I'm okay, sir." The doc pushed up his slippin' spectacles and leaned in closer to make sure of just that. "I can make you better than okay. Dr. Mills and I believe we can cure you. There's a good chance, Blewett." It seemed far-fetched. "Well, good evening. Rest well. I'll get a basket of food to you soon, and then I'll be back for you within the month, about the third week in June," he promised and mounted his horse, not waiting for my reply. Pa was asleep inside. He fluttered his lids and I whispered, "Go back to sleep. I'm just getting my reading material together for next week, then going to tend to Junia." I set down my heavy bonnet beside the door, peeking inside at the gifts. Pa mumbled faintly and coughed, and I could see he'd gone to bed bone-tired, covered in the coal dust, though it looked like he'd at least given his face and arms a half-hearted swipe with a clean cloth. "Shh, rest another hour," I said, and covered him with his sheet. Squinting, he groped for my arm. "Are you well, daughter? He take care of you?" "Yes, sir. Close your eyes now." I hurried to tuck the coarse muslin over him, not wanting to alarm or disturb him with the worries of the day, hoping he'd rest a little more, hoping he wouldn't see what they'd done to me in my eyes. He hitched his thumb to the stool where he'd laid a coal-blackened envelope addressed to R.C. Cole. "Beck passed that to me for the fire watcher boy," Pa said sleepily. Outside, I picked up my book satchel and carefully packed Doc's bottles, the honey, and R.C.'s letter into it, then went to see Junia. The mule bobbed her head, blowing, whinnying in loud brays, eager to see me. I unlatched the gate and led her out of the shed. She nuzzled my chin, stretched her neck for a scratch, then dropped beside me to roll in the grass. Junia romped for a good while before I rounded her back into the stall to feed her. The gate wobbled and I fussed with it, sneaking glimpses to the grave. Pod tried to fix the door the day he'd buried the preacher, but the old stall guard needed a new post and stronger latch. After I'd finally secured it, I leaned back over to grab the soap, towel, and an old hand mirror of Mama's from the bin, then picked up my lantern and headed over to the creek to bathe. The warm spring day dropping behind the hills, a cooling curtain quivering on its tail. Wary, I inspected my arms and searched all over. I'd read about medicine and what doctors do, but it was unsettling that it had been done to me. My parents and other folks in the hills cure themselves with nature, tonics, roots, barks, and herbs, unless some stubborn ailment didn't right itself from the homemade potions. They rarely called upon Doc. I held the mirror up to my face. No matter how many times I'd looked, it always hurt like seeing something horrible for the first time. My skin was still darkened from the hard day, bruised a deep blue. How could the doctors ever change it? I was sure even the strongest potion couldn't do that. Moving the angle of the looking glass to my backside, I checked my shoulders, calves, and bottom. Satisfied I wasn't permanently harmed and had scratches mostly on my pride, I dried myself with a towel. When I got back to the cabin, Pa was rambling about, dressing for the mine. "Pa, it's Saturday. Do you have to go? Let me fix you some supper."
"There's no time, daughter. There's a special meeting tonight before work."
He meant secret, and a union meeting at that. Those type of gatherings were as dangerous as cave-ins, explosions, and the miner's lung, and what the company feared and fought fiercely against. The men clamoring for safer working conditions and more pay were the greatest danger to a mining company. And if the company got word, they'd shut the meetings down with threats and violence, burn a miner's house or two, or make the leader of those talks disappear. Pop plowed his socked feet into his boots by the door. "You do okay in the city, Cussie?" He glanced at me. I wanted to fuss at him like Mom had done when he had those meetings, beg him not to go, but I couldn't bring myself to argue with him or worry him none about my day. He had enough of that already. Pulling the dirty sheets off his bed, I said, "Yes, sir. They took themselves blood and skin samples, is all." Bent to the mattress, I balled up his linens and glimpsed over my shoulder. Seeing his alarm, I added, "Didn't hurt none, just some scratches." "Put some salve on it. And that reminds me, I mean to rent Murphy's horse this week and take the sickle and clean up some of your trails. Thin it all and cut back the briars for you." "Much obliged." I appreciated he would do that for me and Junior. I picked up his lunch bucket and packed Doc's pear and cheese inside, adding a biscuit from the stove. He grunted something I couldn't understand, grabbed his coat and bucket, then slipped out the door with a good night trailing over his shoulder, his hat lit and leading him onto a soft, wide path that disappeared into the fog, the tall, silent pines soldiering him. My belly rumbled. And starved, I gobbled down the rest of the cold, stale biscuits I'd baked this morning. Full, I put on fresh bed sheets, boiled Pa's dirty ones, hauled in his bath, and hurried through my chores. Last, I gathered strips of old fabric and scrubbed them with lye, boiled and rinsed and hung them to dry by the wood stove. Soon, my mind returned to the hospital, and I went over to the mirror and stared, and ran a light hand over myself, my face darkening as I tried to imagine what the doctors had done, how much of me they'd taken. Exhausted in the bone, but fully awake in my mind, I looked around for something, anything, to scrub, to wash away the soils of the day. Up in the loft, I shrugged off my clothing and necessaries, changed, and carried the clothes downstairs. When I had washed and rinsed the garments, scoured and scrubbed them again, and then once again, until the fire sparked from my raw, bleeding hands and cleansed the day's muddle, my troubled thoughts. Only then did I stop. Satisfied, I rubbed my cramped hands with horse liniment, then sat down and pored through reading material, the newest loans and newsprint. The Louisville Times had an article about a fire in the Jefferson Memorial Forest that rangers had battled bravely. Excited for the find, I folded the newspaper to save for RC. I put aside a health pamphlet on baby care for Angeline, then went over and pulled one of Mama's novels from the bookshelf. It had been her favorite and mine too, and I clutched it to my chest, suddenly deciding just what I'd do with it. That it would be the boldest thing I'd ever done didn't matter after the hardness of today. Feeling giddy, I packed it with the others. I remembered Winnie's student asking about the pie recipe and wrote out two different ones for her sister on a scrap of paper and tucked it in my bag. Pleased, I settled back into the chair to read my other favorite, the National Geographic, slowly picking up every word, soaking up all the articles of people and faraway places, searching the smart magazine for others like me. Hours later, I rolled up the dried strips of fabric, got my book satchel, and pulled out the medicine. My hands shook a little holding the precious bottles of laudanum, honey, and alcohol. I moved over to the stove, reached above to the shelf for Loretta's willow bark. Filled with renewed strength and gratitude, I carefully wrapped it and Doc's gifts and tucked them into my bags. Worth more than gold, more than chickens, it was exactly what Mr. Moffat needed to live, and what the Moffat family couldn't live without. Chapter 19. Under the quivering fog, Angeline labored in her garden, hilling a row of potatoes, a melody whisking from her lips, the May air tossing her loose hair. Beyond, gusts of spring winds brushed tips of a mustard patch and the waist-high stickweed beyond, Near the porch, a sagging clothesline hung limp between a tall post and a thick tree. Another breeze skittered past the dingy soaked sheets and raggedy clothing, dipping low and sweeping the laundry across the raw earth. She stood and wiped stained hands on her skirts when she heard Junior's greeting. "Blewett!" Angeline ran to us, nearly tripping over her long, muddied skirts, splashing barefoot through puddles and kicking up muck.
"Junior!"
she cried, and planted a kiss on the mule's velvet muzzle, pulled a small carrot from her pocket, and gave it to her. I dropped to the ground and handed the straps to Angeline. She tethered Junior to the post.
"Is the doc coming? We's been looking for him every day,"
Angeline asked with a rise in her voice on the coming, slipping her hand into her pockets and plucking out a homemade doll.
"Look what I've made for baby honey."
It was a tiny faceless doll made from corn husks, its dress a scrap of orchid fabric Angeline had torn from her own skirts. "It's mighty pretty." I pulled out her seeds I'd wrapped in cheesecloth. "Doc's really busy, Angeline. I'm sorry." She took them and stared at the package for the longest time, a fright piling onto her pale, sweaty face.
"But Willie's got the bad fever now,"
she barely whispered, stuffing Honey's new doll back into her own pocket, her eyes shimmering.
"I ain't been able to cool it none."
I fetched her the tale of Mrs. Tittlemouse and the health pamphlet. "Angeline, I've got something else."
"A bad fever,"
she said and walked away, shaking her head. At the bottom of the rickety porch, she dropped the seeds in the mud and disappeared inside the cabin. "Angeline," I called after her, fishing inside my bags for the medicines. I hurried up the wobbly stones and high-stepped over the tall, scratchy weeds poking through the rotted planks. Pushing open the door, I peeked inside and softly said her name. Steam rose from a pot atop the stove. Scents of shimmering wild grasses hung thick in the shanty. Angeline knelt on the floor next to the bed, face buried in the covers atop Mr. Moffat, sobbing quietly, her tiny shoulders racked with grief and heartbreak. At the head of the bed, a homemade calendar that Angeline had fashioned from a worm-eaten board dangled against the bedpost. She'd carved out honey at the top. A scratch of berry-inked X's marked down the days until her baby's arrival. "Angeline," I called quietly again, going over to her side.
"Don't worry none. I brought medicine. Look."
Mr. Moffat groaned in his sleep, and the bed cover slipped from his leg, showing his wound. The foot was angry red, pocked with yellowish-green pus, a festering sore that seemed to swallow most of his foot. The stink of infection wafted up, watering my eyes, roiling sickly in my belly. Angeline stood and swept a hard hand across her damp cheekbones. "I have willow bark for his fever," I showed her, "and we can clean his foot with this alcohol wash." I pushed the bottles into her hand. "Then you can dress it twice a day with a layer of honey and bandage it with this roll. Here's some laudanum for his rest." Angeline laid them gently at the foot of the bed, studying the treasures, gliding her dirty fingers over the bottles while tears streamed from her eyes. She took a shaky breath, suddenly gasped, and clutched my hand to her belly.
"Oh, oh, feel that? Honey's happy she'll have herself a paw,"
she exclaimed, her bright eyes widening. I felt the baby's strong, rolling kick and then released Angeline's hold. "Let's get that busted foot fixed," I said. Together we went to work, Angeline happily chattering about the baby, the future, and the town's 4th of July picnic Mr. Moffat promised to take her to. I boiled the willow and made a tea, then took a pan of water with a rag over to the bed to begin cleaning the wound. But when I lifted Mr. Moffat's leg, he roused awake and cursed me. "Damn it, don't touch me," he bit, raising his head before collapsing back onto the bed.
"Willie, shush," Angeline said. "Blewett is going to make you bitter."
"No, no," he coughed. "Ain't having a color touch me and bring more infection."
"Willie," Angeline said sharply,
Don't be ornery. I backed away and shifted my eyes to the floor.
Blewett, Angeline said. He don't mean it none. It's the fever.
Ain't having it. Mr. Moffat barked me back farther, and I stumbled over a boot. I glanced at him and saw the fear on his face. His fear looked a lot like hatred or something ugly that had rooted in him and his kin long before me. I turned my head. Be well, Mr. Moffat.
Oh, Blewett, he ain't hisself, Angeline cried out with an outstretched hand.
Don't forget to clean it with the alcohol before you put on the dressing, I whispered and quickly took my leave. Chapter 20. Several hours later, I'd finished my drop-offs at the three cabins and rode into Jackson Lovett's yard, the smells of fresh rain, wild onion, and turned dirt rising into the breeze. Above, fat thunderclouds sailed off to the east, the sheets of rain curtaining layered grandfather ridges that rose beyond. Jackson worked on a late spring garden, taking a hoe to one of the many rows he'd cut. Junia brayed and whinnied, a warning clinging to her last haw. Jackson pulled his shoulders up, laid down his hoe, and walked over to us. Easy, girl, I said as Junia snapped a leg frontward, cautioning him not to come any closer. Jackson pulled a rag from his back pocket and wiped his neck. Whoa, old girl. I plumb forgot it was Monday. But I'm happy to see you, too. I slid down the prancing mule, tapped her foreleg, pushed her back to try to right myself from a wriggling mess she was causing. Finally, I was able to stand and give a proper greeting, get Jackson's loan out of the saddlebag and pass it to him. He wrinkled his brow. What's this? It's your new loan? Well, not an official library loan. It's my mama's, and I'm loaning it out. It was a fairly decent copy of Brave New World. Surprised, he inspected the dust jacket and thumbed through the pages. It was a banned book here, but Pod saved up for 6 months and paid his foreman to fetch it from the city for him one Christmas, years ago, to surprise Mama with it. I searched Jackson's eyes, a worry gathering in mine. It's clean enough, I said with a challenge in my voice, but still buckling under a rising peacock blue blush. I tucked my hands behind my back. The book was clean and less soiled than the real-life stories taking place in these dirty hills. In Aldous Huxley's fable of a future world where everyone was safe, no one suffered illness, starved, or did without, and there were no more wars. One of my favorite parts was when the law broke up an ugly riot. They didn't use guns, arrows, sticks, or fists. Instead, they sprayed a strange misty drug over the crowd that made everyone happy. I imagined the law brewing gallons of skullcap and using the old nerve tonic and mad dog herb to do the same when needed around here. Brushing a lock from my face, I tucked it back under my bonnet, then unclasped my feral hands, now worried I'd been too bold in front of this patron. What if he went to the center and told? I could lose my job for passing a banned book. They would banish me from the books forever. Maybe even think up a worse punishment. At that, my hands itched to snatch the book back and flee. Jackson said, "Your mother has good taste." Had. She done passed. "I'm sorry for your loss," he said with sincerity and looked again at the book. Clean, you say? I've been sorely wanting to read this one, but never could get my hands on it. Thank you, Cussie Mary. I was pleased. More than pleased. Thrilled. Let me get your library loan, he said, and strolled across the yard and into his cabin, returning a minute later with an apple and the Cobb book I'd left with him the last time, along with a different book atop it. He handed me his loan and a copy of Sons by Pearl S. Buck. Have you read it yet? No, but I've heard good things about it, and I've read The Good Earth. It won the Pulitzer. I tried to hand the book back. He raised a palm. It would be my pleasure if you'd read it. And yes, Earth deserved the prize, but I lost that one out west. An excellent book. I liked Olan best, I said, thinking how Olan knowed she was too ugly to be loved. Jackson stared at me a moment, then said, "She was the real hero, you know." Olan was sure enough brave. I admired him saying so. And I liked how she didn't have to say much, neither. "What's unsaid can be just as important," Jackson commented. I nodded, excited to be able to talk about books with him. "I especially liked Farmer Lung's Love of the Land," Jackson said, and looked admiringly out at his own. The power of land held a connection I could reckon with. For me, the earth gives life, and without it, we have none, not the smallest breath. Pa says if we hurt it, it won't feed us. That's what the company's doing. He's right. And the company is careless. I haven't seen a lot of bees up here like when I was young. You hurt old Mother Earth, and she's gonna paddle your hindside, the same as she did to Farmer Lung. I clutched the book to my chest. I'll start on it tonight. If you like it, I have her other in the set, A House Divided. You're welcome to read them both. Much obliged. I didn't think I'd ever get to read her others. Miss Yule and Miss Harriet scolded that her books weren't proper for Kentuckians and could lead to tempting the good morals of our people and offend deeply religious minds. Miss Eula and the librarian supervisors at the center. I imagine they might make a small mind bigger. Jackson grinned playfully, tossing the apple from hand to hand. Reckon that wouldn't be such a bad thing, I said, taking in his easy smile and friendly chatter. Much obliged. I best get back to my route. And I need to get the soil worked before I can cut the timber and daylight's gone embedded. He was strong like a tree, the cut of his face like the mountain surrounding us. You sure have yourself plenty of room to build up here, I said, not wanting to leave, but knowing I should. Eventually I will. It'll take a lot of work. And I'm not a rich man, just a fool one with a strong back. He straightened, loosening the creaks and cramps of overworked bones. I clasped my hands. I don't mean to pry. I don't mind. I'm selling the lumber. I've got more orders for it than I can handle by myself. Enough woods and work to last two lifetimes. I hated to think of it all bare, hurting the earth like that, but there was big business in timber, and bigger money if a man wanted to work hard. Sure is pretty. I'll take only enough trees to have myself a proper barn, to thin these woods some and bring new growth. I nodded. And then, because I had said too much, stayed too long already, let's get to our books, Junior. Thank you for the loan. Good day. It's a fine read. I can't wait to hear what you think of this one. He followed me over to Junior. I stopped. That he would care astonished me, and I could only bleat out another thank you. How's the old girl doing today? He asked the mule and held up the apple. Junior pricked her ears forward, wiggled her back muscles as I mounted her. Jackson took out his knife, cut a big slice, and held it up to the mule. I shifted in the saddle, an uncomfortable rumble vibrating my belly. It had been ages since breakfast, and dinner was still two drops away. Junior snatched it up quickly, her big chopper savoring, enjoying. Jackson took a bite, swallowed, then said, "Would you like some?" He cut another slice and lifted up a fat piece to me. It was a kind present. This and the one in my bags would save me till supper. Before I could think twice, I leaned over Junior's side to take the slice at the same time Jackson stepped over to me. I grasped the fruit, our hands touching. Junior screamed, swung her head sideways, braying loudly at him. The apple slipped from our hands and fell to the ground. I jerked on the mule's reins. Jackson nearly tumbled backward. Junior stomped on the fruit, then barreled out of the yard with me holding on tight. Her indignant cries cobbled across Jackson's amused laughter.
Chapter 21. A short time later, the clouds parted as I rode into the schoolyard, scattering a brood of chickens and a cluster of loud, chasing boys. Winnie rushed out of the schoolhouse, shooing the hens and students out of her way. "I didn't think you'd make it this Monday, Cussie Mary," she said. "So glad you did." I stayed atop Junia. "Sorry, I'm running behind today. I'll fetch your books," I said, feeling guilty because I'd tarried too long at the Moffitts and Jackson Lovett's. Winnie sent Clementine back inside for the loans. The children, all hankering for a peek at the new material, circled around their teacher. I called over Nessie and handed her the recipes for her sister to bake for the big dance, and she spun around and curtsied, then waved the paper. "I'll have to learn her 'cause she can't read. Thank you, bookwoman." The other girls gathered around her as she read the recipes to them. I scanned the students' faces, searching for Henry. He stood in the back of the group, a weakness in his eyes. In a minute, Clementine flew back out of the building, stumbled and dropped the books, kicking up a kaleidoscope of swallowtails. Henry dashed over to her and scowled, picked up the books and dusted the jackets off on his pant legs and sleeves, scolding her as he ran up to me. "Here you are, ma'am," he said, and blew on the books, again swiping the covers with his arms. Henry's face was more hollowed. His bones again poked out of ragged clothes that had been passed down too many times and were tight and ill-fitting. "Thank you, Henry." I bent over and caught the red, glossy necklace circling his neck, the thick, scaly rash on his palms. He had the pellagra and was starving to death, and right before my eyes. With a steady hand, I took the books from him and slipped them into my bags, stretched around to my other satchel, pulling out my saved dinner. I held up the apple. "Everyone inside," Winnie clapped loudly, hurrying over to me, and gave a sharp, startling clap once more, sending Henry and her pupils skittering back into their classroom, and Junia toe-hopping nervously. "Inside, to your desks, now," she warned and clapped once more. Dampness blotted under the armpits of her dress, spreading to her chest. When they were all inside, Winnie said firmly, "You can't feed one, Cussie Mary, without feeding them all. They all have the hunger. Just some of their bodies are able to hide the sickness better than the others." She was right, and it wouldn't be fair. Ashamed, I lowered the fruit to my side. Winnie clasped her hands. "If only we could get more outreach programs up here. If only they could send a block of cheese with every book, a loaf of bread." She tilted her head to the sky as if telling it all to God. I wished it too. Their hunger for books could teach them of a better life free of the hunger. But without food, they'd never live long enough or have the strength to find it. "Just one damn block of cheese," Winnie scratched out in a whisper. I thought about the cheese Doc promised. If I could bargain with him for more food, I could give it to the school children. Winnie sighed, stroked Junia's neck, then gently took the apple from my hand, slipped it into her dress pocket. "Henry's new baby didn't make it," she said quietly. Saddened, I turned to the schoolhouse and saw a blush of boys peeking out the window. One was Henry. "I'll make sure I give this to him," Winnie patted her pocket. "Ride safe and give my best to Martha Hannah and the children." She turned, her long skirts bristling as she hurried back to her charges. From inside, Henry pressed his head to the pane, watching me. I tossed him a smile and vowed silently to get him food. The boy broke into a sluggish grin, struggled to raise the window, once, then again, but was too weak. He coughed, pressed his rash reddened hand to the glass, and mouthed, "Goodbye, bookwoman." Then he was gone, his handprint a milk-ghosted blur disappearing into glass. A shiver left needling my spine. Chapter 22. After we left the schoolyard, I stopped on the path and double-checked my bags. I didn't have a news magazine for Mr. Prynne, so I headed straight to Martha Hannah's, looking forward to having an extra moment to chat with her and the youngins.
I sang lightly as Junior rode us around a covey of oaks, trampled over squaw root and showy jewelweed, until she stopped and sounded an alarm. I'd been thinking about the medical tests, the food, how much I could get from the doc in exchange for giving him more blood. I wondered just how much blood a person could lose, then remembered the article I'd read about Marie Antoinette's bloodletting she'd gotten while giving birth. How it didn't hurt her none to lose the blood. Then I turned my mind to the book Jackson Lovett loaned me and became so riddled in thoughts of him that I hadn't kept a keen eye on the paths. I'd been speculating about his life, his kin. Jackson Lovett had burrowed into me like a tune I couldn't turn off, like the popular Benny Goodman song Blue Moon that played on Harriet's radio from time to time. I scolded myself and vowed not to pry into my patron's affairs, to keep a quiet tongue around the man next time. I'd been too bold and risked my job as well. Junia blew hard as if shaming me, and I snapped my head up and pressed a hand to my galloping heart, half expecting to see Fraser lurking in the woods, still stalking me. I cupped my eyes against the sun, relieved to see Martha Hannah's husband, Devil John, and not another Fraser. But his stance offered no relief, but something more, something disquieting and unbending, and I feared troublesome for me. "Bookwoman," he called out, standing there in his thin breeches and faded shirt, a long rifle strapped over his shoulder. Devil John Smith was a moonshiner, and, folks whispered, one of the best. He wore a black floppy hat with a raccoon dick fastened above the brim, what the bootleggers placed in a Still's copper worm to direct the flow into the catch jug so there wouldn't be any loss of shine, and a handy way to alert a thirsty feller he was in the business. "Mr. Smith." I chanced a wobbly smile, stiffened atop the saddle. "Ma'am," he tipped his hat. "I've come to tell you there's a problem with them books," he said soberly. I felt my smile slip downward. Junia blew a hot breath, and I wrapped the reins tighter around my sweating hands. Devil John went on. "The young'uns won't do their chores, and yesterday Martha Hannah was nearly an hour late with my supper. An hour! Them books are doing that, surely making them lazy. The girls are letting the laundry and sewing pile up around their ears, and the boys are reading at the creek when they ought to be fishing and working the garden. Plum can't get them to work because they so busy sitting and reading them foolish books you're bent on bringing. And I can't have it. Won't have it." "I'm sorry, Mr. Smith," I said, secretly touched they loved the book so dearly. "Without the loans, his young'uns couldn't learn because the moonshiner refused to send them to school. No man, no Kentucky law, could make a hillman do that. Most folks hadn't even heard it was law. The land had its own decrees, held tight its hard ways of handling harder things. Folks would pack their little ones off to school only if it suited them, and not because of something written somewhere far away by city folks they'd never seen or would ever see. They've wasted the kerosene and burned all the candles and damn near broke me," Devil John complained. I reached into my satchel and held up a tape-covered magazine and a scrapbook. "Maybe these will help, sir." Devil John grimaced, shaking his head. "Ain't got no use for any more of them highfalutin books that fritters away time. It's costing me good oil and wick and food, bookwoman. My farming's gone to seed from laziness. Wasteful." "This is boy's life. And look, sir, here's a good mountain book full of house cleaning tips and sewing." He balled up his fists, crossed his arms. "Mr. Smith, the Boy Scouts just sent this latest magazine in. It's about hunting and fishing, and there's Bible stories inside." He took a minute mulling it over. "Sir, boy's life teaches a young'un how to knot rope, make a good fishing cane, and trap rabbit. Good hunting tips inside there, sir." I dismounted and walked the magazine and scrapbook over to him. Though it was said he never partook, only bootlegged to provide for his family, Devil John still smelled a sweet mash from working his still, the angel's share and what folks called the escaping spirits inside barrels. He loomed over me in his cow shoes, the large wooden blocks carved into cow hoofs that he'd attached to his boot soles to leave hoof prints and trick the revenuers. Mr. Smith, there's also an interesting article on tannin and some nice prayers they can learn. There's some old church bulletins and a pastor's sermons inside the scrapbook.
Sermons? He boomed, locking eyes with mine. I don't need a charlatan's fire wagon finger up my ass. The likes of that old devil Fraser pastor's falsehoods in my home.
Junia blew hard and stomped a hoof. I gasped and tore my eyes away, shaken inside, but not before I heard something more and how he'd said it. My mind pulled to Fraser's attack. I'd seen a shadow and heard a noise that day. Had Devil John found Junia and sent her back to me? Had he seen Fraser accost me? Seen where Fraser lay? Devil John saw a lot in these woods, knowed every stick and stink of it. Finally, I caught my breath and squeaked out, "No, sir. Yes, sir." He frowned and scanned the woods, thinking,
"It's been a while since I've seen the false parson man, and if I never hear from him again, it'll be none too soon."
I swallowed my agreement. He quieted a bit.
"My Martha Hannah sees to their Bible studies. Reads to him at first light and every night," he clipped, darting his eyes to the boy's life and then to me, and once more back to the magazine, before snatching it from my hand and quickly fanning the pages.
"Yes, sir, I'm sure Martha Hannah does a fine job. And there's a lot of other fine things in the scrapbook for her, some tasty recipes for her to make." The book shook a little in my hand. "There's a pattern for breeches and instructions for making a good hickory basket and a couple of cannon recipes. Lots of fine chores in there, Mr. Smith." I opened the scrapbook and showed him a recipe for sweetbread and another for a meat and onion pie. "That's Mrs. Hamilton's prized pie." I tapped the page and handed to him, hoping he'd let his wife have it.
"My garden ain't even hoed 'cause they's been reading too much."
Still, he took it and pondered whether to trust what I'd said. Not knowing how to read, Devil John waited in his hands and snuck glimpses at me in the recipes. He opened the boy's life again, tapped a title beside a fish.
"What's this say, bookwoman?"
"A Boy's Guide to Fishing," I slowly read, underlining the words with my finger.
"A Boy's Guide to Fishing," he mouthed and trailed the print.
"This word here," he pointed, "says boy." "Yes, sir. Boy, B-O-Y." He worked his tongue over the spelling.
"This one's fishing, then."
"Fishing," I slowly pronounced, pausing my finger at the syllables. F-I-S-H-I-N-G.
"Fishing."
He followed earnestly, mouthing the letters again, and then stole another glance at the scrapbook I held. Junia nudged my back, rested her head on my shoulder, and kept her big eyes nailed on him.
Mr. Smith, did I mention that Mrs. Hamilton's husband also has a dandy tip on picking the best witch sticks in there?"
Devil John tucked the boy's life under his arm and flipped through the scrapbook.
"Real good diviner tip, sir.
Mountain folk and bootleggers always looked for good water and places for new wells. Diviner Mr. Hamilton was a reputable water witch, and he'd used his forked peach switches to find water for decades, staking the spot when the twig pulled to it. It was true nary a soul ever dug a dry hole when Mr. Hamilton witched for a well. Hamilton's finds were so accurate that folks said he could tell a feller how many feet down the water was by the number of times his switch nodded over a spot."
"Well, I reckon these can't hurt none. Might get 'em working,"
Devil John said lazily, tugging his beard. Another long moment passed then. "But only bring the cannon and recipe books after planting and after harvest. Only that. Only then. They'll not have the others till winter, and only after I see to it they've finished their chores. And not a minute sooner." He clutched the books in the crook of his arm and lifted a finger. "Not one Kentucky second sooner, bookwoman."
"Yes, sir," I swallowed hard. "Please give Martha Hannah and the young'uns my regards."
I watched him slip cat-like into the trees despite his big, clunky cow shoes. A dangerous man, and also a strong, providing one, but someone you dared not cross. I wiped a damp brow and hurried Junior onward toward Miss Loretta's. We wouldn't rest until safely through the forest. Chapter 23. When R.C. Cole spotted me late Wednesday morning, he raised his arm, let out a whoop atop the tower railing, and flew down the steps barefoot like a bald hornet had lit after him, the steel stairs trumpeting an echo across Hogtail Mountain that clanged against Rockface. At the bottom, he absently shoved me his loan, practically dancing for the envelope while tucking the newspaper I handed him under his sweaty arm without even a glance. I found an article about a forest fire, I said, and gave him the letter from Mr. Beck, and went over to Mount Junia, leaving him to his privacy. He ripped open the envelope. I heard a hiss, turned and saw his paling face, the tears blurring and reddening his eyes. He done said no, R.C. murmured, swiping the back of his hand across his lids. No, said I wasn't good enough for Ruth, and my work ain't honorable, and I ain't got myself a proper home for his daughter. R.C. rattled the letter. He aims to have her take a coal miner for a husband. He thrust a fisted letter into the air. A coal miner! I whisked out a sorry for him. I get good pay, and I'll get more when I'm a ranger. I'll build her a fine home, finer than any coal miner could. He slapped the letter against his leg. I will. I knowed you can do it, R.C. Just keep reading, and I'll keep bringing the books. Look. He lifted the paper and tapped the page. He says he won't give her hand to anyone in the We Poke Along program. Calls it lazy work. I winced. That's what some folks call the WPA program. A lot of men around these parts would rather starve than participate. They thought it was charity, dishonorable, and downright sinful to take the 75 cents a day the government offered to erect simple outdoor privies for folks who had none, build access roads into the hills and around, or lay split timber bridges across creeks. Lazy work, the prouder hillman claimed. R.C. stretched his neck up to the watchtower, misery rippling across his freckled brow. But I love her. He slowly folded the letter and rolled it into the newspaper, tucking it all into his loose waistband. I ain't letting her go. Ain't letting a dirt digger have my girl. I cringed, thinking about Pa and the other miners, but knowed the young boy was hurting and didn't mean it. I've got to get to the train depot. Get my bride, he said, and clenched his jaw and took off down the mountain, his feet pounding the declaration into the red dirt path. I didn't know a lick about matters of the heart, other than what I'd read in books, but my hand curled into a tight fist and lifted up his declaration for a victory. Chapter 24. For the rest of May, leading up to the pie bake dance, there was talk about Vester Frazier's disappearance, and a few suspicions on his whereabouts. Everything from him running off with a floozy to him falling prey to a hungry bear or pack of mean dogs. Folks around here had heard about my short union with Charlie Frazier, but they didn't know spit about his kin accosting me. The talk didn't bother me much. Folks knowed the Blues were unchurched and didn't associate with the preacher. But I couldn't help fearing he'd be discovered. Worry on what Devil John might have seen. Worry more that Doc would let something slip, or someone's hunting dog would come along and dig him up. Lately, I'd been peeking behind Junior's stall, scattering leaves atop the preacher's grave, piling on more sticks, rock, then dragging logs from the woodpile onto it. Made sure he stayed good and put. Couldn't push his devil-rotted firewagon fingers up from the black earth and grab himself another sinner. Pod fussed at me and ordered me to stop, saying I was making it worse by stacking a big marker like that. But I couldn't stop fretting over Frazier's grave, stop piling on more debris. The last week of May rolled in, and Pa made sure I wouldn't fuss the matter again. I awoke and found the site cleared, the hole empty. and Pa's conversation just as vacant. Folks' talk drifted from the missing preacher to the union fighting for more pay and better working conditions for the miners and the young boys picking slate down in the hole and making pleas for better living quarters in the mine camp on the other side of town. The company came back with a vengeance against the union. There was more violence, threats of shutting down the mines, and coal miners' strange disappearances. Beginning with Pa's. 2 days earlier, I had come home from my route and found him gone, thinking he was off to one of his meetings. But the next morning, when he still hadn't returned, I was beside myself. I'd paced the cabin, spitting out prayers, wearing the old floorboards until the rhythm of the creaks and groans skint my nerves and drove me outside. I ran over to Junior's stall and cried out, "We've got to go find him." We trailed Pa's route to work, searching for any clues of an animal attack, anything that might lead me to him, until we saw the mine in the distance, and I pulled the reins and brought Junior to a halt. I was frantic for news, but I didn't dare go closer, and I couldn't ask openly in town. Hoping to get word of Pa's whereabouts, I'd penned a letter yesterday when he still hadn't returned. I addressed it to Mr. Moore, a coal miner I'd heard Pa speak kindly of, and then boldly rode over to Queenie's house and asked her Grandma Willow to give it to her. It had taken half the morning, and I spent the rest of the day riding the mule hard to make up the lost time taken from my book route. Pa'd been gone 3 days now, and I hadn't 3 seconds apiece worrying it all. And when the couriers had left notes at the librarian's outpost requesting we come into the center a week early to help with the large delivery the railroad had left, I was more than eager, hoping Queenie would bring news of Pa, or I'd see him in town. Inside the center, I sorted the mail and reading material at my table, keeping an eye on the company store across the street and on the lookout for Pa. If I heard noises outside, I'd rush over to the window to see if it was Queenie, hoping Willow remembered to give her my letter. Several times I dropped things, the nerves whittling me down. When Harriet slammed a stack of catalog cards onto my table, I jumped, knocking books onto the floor. "What's wrong with you?" she snapped, looking at me suspiciously, slapping down more cards. "You sick or something?" She took a step away from me. "You've been clumsy all morning." "No, ma'am. Sorry," I mumbled and picked up the books and began sorting the cards into the makeshift filing cabinets we'd made from cheese boxes the company store had set out for trash, while Eula and Harriet gossiped about the upcoming dance this Friday. Out of the corner of my eye, I spotted Doc outside, and he raised a friendly hand in passing. He still hadn't dropped off the promised basket of food, and I wished I could ask him about it. Doc had mentioned the last time we drove from Lexington that he'd pick me up the third Saturday in June, so I reckoned I'd have to wait till then to talk to him. I looked over at Eula and Harriet talking about the pie bake dance, tempted to slip out and speak with him, but I quickly lost my courage when he disappeared into the company store. I'd make sure to ask him for the food on the way to the city. It was a relief knowing Winnie would have it for her school children. And for a few minutes, I let myself imagine the students stuffed and happy, looking like the fattened children in my storybooks. Eula changed the conversation and chatted about the penny fund that Lena Nossier was starting, and I perked at the mention. Miss Nossier was the chairman of the librarian service for the Kentucky PTA and pushed each member to donate a penny to purchase new books. It sure would be something to have a room full of new books, satchels brimming with them, and to see the looks on the hill folks' faces. It would be thrilling to hand out stacks of the latest newspapers and brightly colored magazines and books with their perfect new covers, fresh ink and crisp pages. I kept an eye on the street and filed the catalog cards, picking up pieces of Eula and Harriet's other tattles, one about a partial cave-in at the mine, the company shutting down coal production and pulling out, somebody's lost hunting dog, and the recent births of several babies. I'd heard about the cave-in weeks ago when Pa told me about the 2 small boys who had to be dug out. Both of the women dropped their voices to a near whisper, looked around in all directions and right past me. They didn't care if I heard. My presence was of no more matter than a spent moth on a sill. Still, I'd kept an ear bent, listening for the hard and hurtful things others might say about me and mine. Seems I had learned to hear a lot of talk that other folks didn't think I could. Harriet prattled while binding a book. Mrs. Vance had her babe 7 months after she wed, though she's claiming a sudden fever brought it early. It had fingernails on it like an old woman's, Eula said. 9 months of nail growing if I've ever seen one. 9 months after he first came a-courtin', Harriet snorted. Oh, did you see Mabel Moss's new baby? Eula's eyes rounded. It was born with an ugly red stain across its long tongue that ran out onto its lip that ain't lifted. Uh-huh, and Mabel's done insisted the baby got it by falling off the birthing bed, Harriet said. I pity poor Mr. Moss having wed the homely girl only for her to give him a long-tongued liar. It is surely the mark of a liar, Eula agreed gravely. I moved up by the women to stack books onto the old loft ladders we'd hung across the walls for the books. Stepping behind their tables, I kept an eye on them and an ear cocked to their words, hoping for any news of the missing miners, of Pa. They whispered about other folks' latest ailings, Harriet's newest, and the Lysol douche she was using to cure it. I stretched my ear to listen to Harriet's shocking illness. It's... Harriet stood and leaned over her table toward Eula, grabbing the edge. In an elaborately hushed voice, she said, Well, I'd had this horrible itch. Harriet pointed to Eula's privates, then jerked her flushed face up when Eula's gaze fell below Harriet's belly. I couldn't go to the physician. It wouldn't be proper. She paused, snatched glances all around again for anyone who might have slipped into the center, her face coloring ripe red. Eula bobbed her head in sympathy, though there weren't none in her rounding eyes. Well, Harriet dipped her voice lower and caused me to strain. Then I spied an advertisement in Movie Mirror. Mind you, I was only checking it for any filthiness that might offend our God-fearing patrons when I saw a picture of the brown bottle of Lysol, touting the inner rinse that would clean and kill germs. I had also seen the feminine hygiene advertisements in magazines and newspapers. The pictures of the weeping lady with the dainty hanky to her eyes showed she'd been a good mother, good housekeeper, good hostess, good cook, all those things, until 6 p.m. The feminine wash advertisement scolded the sad lady, insisted the perfect homemaker did one disgraceful thing her husband couldn't forgive by forgetting her smelly lady parts. It warned womenfolk about the dangers of neglecting intimate personal hygiene and reminded them to use the feminine wash to keep from wrecking a marriage. A powerful germicide, the product promised,